Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The battle lines are drawn between a federal judge and Florida's governor and cabinet over the matter of how and if former felons should ever get their voting rights back.
Allowing those men and women who have served their sentence to be active participants in their communities again and to have the right to vote.
Also this week, Florida's new budget for the fiscal year has received TaxWatch's annual report card, and the group has found some issues.
Heading into the session, state economists warned that the state general revenue spending is growing faster than available revenue. Budget shortfalls of $1.1 and $1.6 billion loom in the next 2 years.
We'll also learn how many amendments to the Florida Constitution might face the state's beleaguered voters in November, hear about a worsening state report card when it comes to children's issues, and discover why Florida has two state capitol buildings. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Just days after Attorney General Pam Bondi filed an appeal of District Judge Mark Walker's ruling the Clemency Board must overhaul Florida's voting rights restoration process for felons, Bondi and Governor Rick Scott are unflinching in defense of their position. We get that story from Ryan Daly.
District Judge Mark Walker last week gave the Clemency Board until April 26th to overhaul a restoration scheme that he calls arbitrary. Attorney General Pam Bondi says the appeal she filed this week on behalf of the board, which she sits on, is just another part of her job.
This is my duty to the Constitution. When I put my hand on a Bible, I swore to protect the Constitution of the state of Florida and our laws, and that's what I'm doing. I am the legal counsel, so I'm not going to comment on this any further, but we will be appealing.
Democratic Representative Sean Shaw is running for the Attorney General seat in the 2018 election. Responding to Bondi's comment, he says he does not interpret the role in the same way Bondi does.
She obviously disagrees with the ruling, and so she believes it's her duty to have to challenge it and have to continue appealing it. You're seeing how two different people would address the same issue. I don't believe it's the duty, the requirement of the Attorney General to appeal a ruling that calls something Florida's doing unconstitutional.
Meanwhile, Governor Rick Scott has maintained his support of the current system. As it stands, people with a felony must wait a mandatory 5 years before applying to be seen by the Clemency Board, which can take as long as 10 years in some cases. Scott says he has the best interest of the victims in mind.
I think that elected officials are to be making those decisions, not federal judges. If you stop and think about it, these are felons they're talking about. These are felons that could be murderers. There's some of them are going to be, crimes against kids. There's a variety of individuals like this. And so if you look at the Clemency Board, what we look at a variety of things. We look at their domestic violence issues. We look at mortgage fraud issues. We look at a variety of things because we want people to think about how do we take care of the victims of these things.
Democratic gubernatorial candidates are sounding off. Quinn Graham calls the appeal by the Clemency Board an attempt at voter suppression.
The voter suppression that has gone on by this administration in particular, people are very aware of it. And I think that it will be a significant issue. It's an issue of allowing those men and women who have served their sentence to be active participants in their communities again and to have the right to vote, which is the greatest right.
And Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine, who will face Graham in the Democratic primary, likened Governor Scott's move to those of President Donald Trump.
I believe that Governor Scott's actions and Pam Bondi are shameful. They go against who we are as a country, who we are as a state of second chances. And that's not what the American dream is about. And I got to tell you, I'm saddened. I don't know if they did it on purpose. If they did, clearly it's vindictive and it's cruel and it's mean. But then again, I guess, listen, Governor Scott is acting the same way as BFF. Donald Trump acts in the same manner. And hopefully that people will remember this. And on the ballot box in November, they will make their voices heard.
Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, also vying for the Democratic nomination, said the clemency board is, quote, on the wrong side of history. Chris King, the Orlando businessman also seeking the Democratic nod, tweeted the board's appeal is an unmitigated outrage. Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam, who is running for governor on the Republican ticket, sits on the clemency board alongside Bondi and Scott. In a statement, he called District Judge Mark Walker's ruling unconstitutional and extreme. Speaker of the Florida House Richard Corcoran has yet to announce a run for governor. He has, however, received a preemptive endorsement from Congressman Matt Gaetz. In a statement, Corcoran backed the board's appeal and criticized what he calls activist judges who attempt to rewrite laws. Still, Judge Walker doesn't intend to let the clemency board off easily. He filed an order denying their appeal the same day of its filing. Walker was matter of fact in his wording, writing, quote, "This court does not play games. This court is not going to sit on defendant's motion and run out the clock." Pam Bondi, though, says she and the board will take their appeal to the highest court necessary.
We will appeal this to the highest level.
Why?
Because we have been following the law. We firmly believe it is the law in the state of Florida, and we plan on enforcing the laws. And that's what I do as chief legal officer of the state of Florida. So, yes, we are appealing it, and we will appeal it to the highest court.
Judge Walker appeared to poke fun at the clemency board in his rebuttal ruling. Having given them only 30 days to overhaul the process, Walker says the board in their appeal stamp their feet and wail about Walker's deadline, which they claim is unreasonable. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
Governor Rick Scott signed off on an $88.7 billion budget plan for the upcoming fiscal year quicker than many expected. But that didn't prevent the nonprofit organization Florida Tax Watch from releasing its annual Budget Turkey Watch report. The group says it sees some troubling trends, as we hear from Andrew Quintana.
Tax Watch's recent report on Governor Rick Scott's budget plan showed a decrease in the number of approved projects that skipped committee meetings, or in their words, turkeys. Tax Watch Vice President of Research Kurt Wenner says this is due to a law passed last year.
Due to the appropriation rules implemented last year, there were no new projects added to the budget during conference. This has historically made up a large part of budget turkeys. This year, almost all of the turkeys were flagged because they circumvented established selection processes.
But, according to Wenner, all this has done is divert these turkeys to committees loosely related to the projects, causing vetted and approved projects to be neglected.
There were 489 projects that were approved and ranked by the Department of State. The Cultural Museum General Program Support Grants. These requests totaled $41.6 million. The legislature provided $2.6 million to be spread out among all these almost 500 projects. The approved recipients will receive about 6% of what they requested, with awards ranging from $369 to $9,000.
This strategy has created a trend when it comes to filing bills. In 2018, House members filed 1,300 bills, which requested $2.3 billion in appropriations. The Senate requested about 1,400 projects that totaled $2.7 billion. This kind of funding has caused analysts to claim that the state's general revenue spending is surpassing available revenue. The state's annual long-range economic outlook even projects budget shortfalls of $1.1 billion and $1.6 billion in the 2019-2020 and 2021 fiscal years. TaxWatch President and CEO Dominic Calabro says there must be a philosophical change to combat Florida's deficit.
Florida's in a great position in many, many respects. We just want to make sure it continues that way. And to do so, we've got to make sure that our recurring expenditures get more closely aligned with our recurring revenues. And to do that, we've probably got to curtail some of the spending.
The group has offered a list of recommendations to cut back on project spending. They include proper member project legislation and a competitive selection process. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Andrew Quintana.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida's been trying for years to do more to help its children, but a new report shows that effort has been losing steam.
Other preventions and interventions are struggling under the weight of too much demand in a fast-growing state and not enough resources.
A proposal to ban greyhound racing could end up on the Florida ballot, but only if it gets enough votes from the state's Constitution Revision Commission.
You know, if that were the vote that day to send these to the ballot, those would not have gone to the ballot.
The latest report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation shows Florida's progress in several key indicators is starting to stall when it comes to improving the lives of children. While Florida has made progress in areas like educational outcomes, it continues to rank near the bottom of states on other points. Now, as Lynn Hatter reports, a leading children's advocacy organization is calling for changes.
In Leon County, home to the state capital, county commissioners are considering a new tax, one that's aimed at boosting children's services. Speaking to reporters Thursday, Children's Campaign of Florida founder Roy Miller called those levies a good idea.
I mean, they put money into, an underfunded, system of services for children that just wouldn't exist. I mean, anywhere from $50 to $110 million. It makes a real difference. It won't remove the need for the state to step up its investment or the federal government, but it certainly makes a big improvement.
The county is considering creating a new group that would be able to levy the tax worth an estimated $8 million. However, there's still debate over how the money would be used. Ideas include funneling more dollars to address homelessness, mental health, and juvenile incarceration. And the Leon County School District would like that funding to support early childhood education. A similar tax is in play in Lee, Orange, and Brevard counties. And Miller says that's because the state is not properly funding those services.
Across the board, prenatal programs, special needs, child protection, foster care, gender-specific responses, mental health services, other preventions and interventions are struggling under the weight of too much demand in a fast-growing state and not enough resources.
Miller's Children's Campaign is partnering with other advocacy groups from across the state to address what they say are neglected children's issues. In its annual Kids Count report, the Annie E. Casey Foundation notes Florida's progress has stagnated. Despite some educational gains, the state is in the bottom when it comes to overall child well-being due to little progress made in addressing poverty and the increase in drug overdoses due to the opioid epidemic. The high rate of overdoses is leaving children parentless, steering them into the state's foster care system. And Hillsborough County says Lutheran Services Florida's Chris Ford has become the focal point of the problem.
The numbers of kids have come into that system have grown significantly. There are much higher rate of removal in Hillsborough County than anywhere else in the state. And those children, we knew 10 months ago we had a problem.
Card says there aren't enough foster homes to take care of the kids in need, leading to some sleeping in the offices of social workers and some sleeping in cars. And the Children's Campaign's Miller is also worried about how the debate over gun control is affecting another issue, mental health, where services for kids are in short supply.
On the mental health issue, one of the items that the Florida Children's Campaign is going to tend to is we really want to work hard to make sure that tragedy is not equated with mental health services. Stigma keeps a lot of people from seeking help.
The Florida legislature approved millions in mental health funding as part of its response to the Parkland shooting. But many mental health organizations are concerned about the thin line they say exists between punishment and treatment. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Despite a two-hour public hearing held earlier this week to limit visitation hours, the Florida Department of Corrections intends to keep normal visitation hours this weekend at all its correctional facilities. The rule change, originally scheduled to take effect Saturday, would have limited visitation to correctional facilities to essentially two per month for a minimum of 2 hours, and that may have depended on the inmate's number within the prison system. Today, you can visit every Saturday and Sunday from 9 until 3. About 100 people trekked to Tallahassee for the two-hour hearing to voice their opposition to the proposed rule change. They included Forgotten Majority's Judy Thompson, who spoke with our own Sasha Cordner.
So at this public hearing, the Florida Department of Corrections officials named two reasons for this rule change. One was staffing shortages, and another was contraband brought in by visitors like cell phones and drugs. Here's Richard Comerford, the prison agency's assistant deputy secretary of institutions, who also chaired that hearing.
And many of these incidents in contraband have been linked to visitation.
So, Ms. Thompson, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts were that that data is just not true. It has been shown by the Florida Department of Corrections that only 2.5% of contraband is brought into any prison by visitors or family members. That 2.5% is an insignificant number. You do not base a new policy, a new rule change, separating, tearing, and families apart on a 2.5 percentile, because that's 97.5% of visitors and family members that do not bring in contraband. Where is the other 97.5 coming from is the question. And we all know it's coming from those who work or volunteer at the Florida Department of Corrections. So it's an excuse that they use. It's a very weak excuse and a very insignificant percentage.
And why is this important to you?
Well, it's important to me for two reasons. Number one, I have a son that's in prison, which is the reason Forgotten Majority got started, actually. Normally, you have to be impacted by something to get into it and to pursue it passionately. But the other reason is that I have a lot of friends, and I know a lot of people who have husbands that are incarcerated and have life sentences. And what this means most to a spouse or to little children who are taken to see their parent, whether it's mom or dad, it means that that familial relationship would be fractured. It would be shattered. It would be weakened, actually. You can only see your dad, you know, twice a month if you can get there on that day that you are assigned, because even the every other one day per weekend is assigned by the last number of the DC number. But what if I can't make it that day? A child will see their parent once during that month, or a wife will see her husband one time a month. That is cruel. That is cruel. They want to push video visitation at a price, by the way. Visitation would no longer be free. But if, in fact, video visitation was implemented, there'd be no touch, there'd be no hug, warmth, kiss, that type thing. So you're taking away those humane things, the things that are good for you, the things that are warm and healthy for you, being able to look into the eyes of someone you love where you can see love coming back to you. That's what we're all about. We're human beings. We're not animals. And even a dog has to be patted or rubbed more than twice a month. That's what they want to take away from us. And that's why I am passionately opposed to this. It's inhumane, and from my standpoint, only for the almighty dollar, only to make another dollar. There is no benefit to video visitation unless it's used as a supplement, like I said at the hearing, or a complement or an addition to regular in-person visitation. It's one of the most callous things that you can do, and it's going to cause disruptions in the prison, because visitation as it stands now placates the inmate. The family can see each other, touch each other, pray together. You're taking that away. You're stirring up problems and troubles and abuses within the institution. And for what? For Securus Technologies to make another dollar on a video visitation screen?
And I should say that a Florida Department of Corrections spokeswoman has said the video calls are not intended to replace personal visits. Also, that same spokeswoman says right now her agency is weighing everything from Tuesday's testimony and emails they're getting. Michelle Gladdy says there will also likely be another hearing. So my question to you is, will you be at that hearing? And what do you hope for going forward?
Without a question of a doubt, if I have to fly there, I would definitely be there. I think that when they put this regulation or this policy or this plan together, I think when they sit down and talk about these things, it would be nice for them to include the major stakeholders, which are the family members or the significant others of those who are incarcerated. How can you just sit in an office and put together a rule and a plan? And that's why they're having this difficulty. Our bottom line is that they maintain visitation as is every Saturday, every Sunday from 9 to 3. That's simple. you know, and get your officers for the other 97.5 of the contraband that goes into those institutions. So thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak.
That was Forgotten Majority's Judy Thompson speaking with Florida Public Radio's Sasha Cordner about Tuesday's public hearing on considering changes to prison visitation hours. And should the prison agency go ahead with implementing the proposed rule, Thompson says there may be a boycott or a lawsuit filed at some point. Florida Department of Corrections spokeswoman Michelle Glady says if there is a rule change, corrections officials intend to reevaluate it again in 3 months. A proposed amendment to the Florida Constitution would ban greyhound racing in the state. The measure is moving through the Constitution Revision Commission process, but Regan McCarthy reports it faces another roadblock before it can head to the ballot.
Greyhound racing has been a controversial issue in the state of Florida for years. For some, like Carrie Teal with the organization Grey2K, it's a clear animal rights issue.
On average, a greyhound dies every 3 days at a Florida dog track. According to the official state records, 94% of the dogs that died were 3 years old or younger. Many of the death reports do not indicate why the dog died. It just says, dog died on this date, and there's no further data. But we have looked very closely at the death reports, and we were able to directly attribute 60% of them roughly to race incidents. Dog suffered a broken neck, dog didn't finish a race, and then dies later that day.
But for others, greyhound racing is the business they've built their lives around. Former Florida Lieutenant Governor Jeff Kottkamp represents the Florida Greyhound Association.
It's in their own self-interest to do what's best for the health and welfare of the dogs. In fact, that's pretty much what drives them every day. This is how these 8,000 people make their living. They would never overtly do something to harm the animals that they not only love, but make a living from.
That push and pull between interest groups has left the legislature unable or unwilling to take much action on the issue. That's why Republican Senator Tom Lee, who is also a member of the CRC, wants to take the issue to the people through a proposed constitutional amendment.
The legislature has been grappling with this since I returned to the legislature in 2013. And, of course, this commission is one of its great promises is that it is less encumbered by some of the influences and less compromised by some of the influences that the legislature has to be attendant to. And it is my hope that what is bogged down in the legislature and they've been unable to achieve, we can accomplish through this Constitutional Revision Commission.
Lee's proposal would ban wagering on greyhound racing in the state, but would let tracks that currently host greyhound races continue other kinds of gambling, like poker. The proposal is moving through the CRC process. It's passed two committees, and the full body forwarded on to the Style and Drafting Committee.
This is committee substitute for Proposal 67 relating to greyhounds by Commissioner Lee. Are there any amendments?
Style and Drafting Committee Chair Brecht Hoychen says one of the main jobs of the committee is to consider how the proposal should be presented on the ballot.
We must decide the manner in which we will group and order the 25 proposals as amended for presentation to the voters. Last week, I requested that committee members provide suggested groupings to staff, which we've received.
But that idea of grouping causes heartburn for some, like commission member and Florida House Representative Chris Sprowls.
Commissioner Martinez talked about, you know, grouping some proposals, and there may be strategy there, right? I mean, so some people might think, well, if it's grouped with this, maybe it brings it up, maybe it brings it down. My concern with the ones that got less than 22 votes is, you know, if that were the vote that day to send these to the ballot, those would not have gone to the ballot. They would not.
Lee's Greyhound proposal received 18 votes. That's enough to send it to the Style and Drafting Committee, but a proposal requires 22 votes to make it to the ballot. The official vote sheet shows 14 commissioners voted against it. 5 did not cast votes. Commissioners are expected to hold a final floor session later this month in which they'll send proposals to the ballot for voter approval. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, This weekend is the 50th anniversary of Springtime Tallahassee. Weather permitting, which is not at all certain as we speak this evening, there will be a parade, a downtown festival, lots of music, food, fun, and frolic for all. But half a century ago, this celebration was actually a desperate attempt by the locals to keep the Florida legislature from moving the state capital to Central Florida. Ultimately, that campaign was successful. But just 10 years later, there was another grassroots campaign in Tallahassee. A new, modern, 22-story Capitol building had sprung up, looming over the historic old Capitol. A building, says Florida's retired historic preservation architect Dave Farrow, that was very old and very special.
It's a classically inspired building. At its core, the original 1845 structure is still there. And in 1902, when Frank Milburn expanded the building, he added the structure to the north and the south, created more monumental porticos on the east and west, and then added the dome, which is, you know, so much a character-defining feature of the city of Tallahassee now.
But in 1978, the overwhelming sentiment among state government leaders was to tear the old building down. Christy Kuntz remembers it well.
Governor Askew was one of the leaders of the pack. Now, we must say, though, he in later years, I think, became a real proponent of the old Capitol and served as the chair of one of the boards associated with the old Capitol.
Many lawmakers also favored demolition, but members of the Capitol Press Corps sprang to the endangered building's defense, and Kuntz helped coordinate a public rally called Save the Old Capitol Night.
The memory that's most vivid and remains so for me is looking out the front doors right before the event was to start, and there were people as far as the eye could see.
Public opinion saved the day, and the old Capitol, soon restored to its candy-striped awning 1902 glory, now attracts many thousands of visitors a year, says Tiffany Baker, director of the Historic Capitol Museum.
I think there's no argument that Tallahassee would look very different if we had not saved that historic structure.
Having helped with that project, Friedrich Mittner, president of the Florida Trust for Historic Preservation, says her organization was even more energized to support similar efforts statewide.
And so what was great is the thoughtful citizens' actions in saving it is then what was the impetus for the Florida Trust for Historic Preservation. I thought, well, if we can, you know, participate in that campaign to save the old Florida Capitol, what other preservation issues can we take on a statewide level?
So the next time you visit Tallahassee, you might want to stop by the old Capitol. You'll recognize it right away. It's the building you see in all the political ads. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank Andrew Quintana. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.